ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, it's Patricia Carvelis here. I'm the host of the Politics Now podcast, and I spend a lot of time talking to politicians, usually grilling them. But over summer, I want to introduce you to the people behind the politics. What will Tim Wilson never compromise on? What's the worst criticism Josh Burns has ever received? And did Larissa Waters realise she was changing history when she fed her screaming baby in the chamber? You can find the interview series in the Politics Now podcast feed.
He's known for relentlessly and ruthlessly pursuing Donald Trump's agenda and for playing a big part in shaping it. Now, with the extraordinary start to 2026, which has included the capture of the Venezuelan president and a threat to take over Greenland, there's a renewed focus on the US president's right-hand man, Stephen Miller. Today's staff writer for The Atlantic, Ashley Parker, on her investigation into Trump's deputy chief of staff, his power and growing influence. I'm Sam Hawley on Gadigal Land in Sydney. This is ABC News Daily. Ashley, there has been a lot going on in the world at the start of 2026, which is somewhat of an understatement at this point. But look, a heap of it comes down to two men. One is, of course, Donald Trump, and the second is Trump's deputy chief of staff, Stephen Miller. By the sounds of it, he shouldn't be messed around with, Mr. Miller. Just tell me about his approach.
Yeah, I mean, Stephen Miller has an incredibly relentless, intense, urgent approach for his very hardline far-right views.
Vote for the right to have a secure sovereign border and for the right to have a government that puts American citizens ahead of illegal aliens.
Our lineage and our legacy hails back to Athens, to Rome. Our ancestors built the cities. They produced the art and architecture. They built the industry.
To all ICE officers, you have federal immunity in the conduct of your duties. And no one, no leftist agitator or domestic insurrectionist can prevent you from fulfilling your legal obligations and duties.
So he's always held hardline far-right views, especially on immigration. As I was reporting my profile of him, this didn't make it into the profile, but someone told me, look, if Stephen could choose how he got to spend 500% of his day, he would spend it all on immigration. But now he actually has a much bigger role in the administration and a much broader purview, which is one of the reasons we wanted to write this story, because it didn't feel fully understood that not only is he directing and making and executing immigration policy, he's doing the same on foreign policy, on education policy, on trade policy. He just really has a hand in about everything the administration is doing.
So you wrote a profile piece on him for The Atlantic. You didn't get to speak to him directly, did you? But you learned a lot.
Yes.
About what drives him.
We didn't get to speak to him, unfortunately, but we did learn a lot about him because we spoke to dozens of people who know him and like him and know him and don't like him. So we felt like we got a very kaleidoscopic view of him. And one of the things that he is very sensitive to is this idea that he is sort of the puppet master pulling the strings and manipulating the president. And, you know, there's people who call him the prime minister. And that in his argument is that he is just executing the president's policies as ruthlessly and efficiently and urgently as he can. And that is both true and also more complex. You know, in reporting this piece, I asked a number of people. Stephen Miller is much more extreme than Trump on certain issues, especially immigration. The president has alluded to this himself, kind of publicly made a joke about it.
I want to thank Stephen Miller, who's right back in the audience right there. And I'd love to have him come up and explain his true feelings, but maybe not his truest feelings. That might be going a little bit too far.
And so I said, what happens if, you know, they're debating, say, an immigration policy and Stephen's making his case, and at the end of the day, the president does something slightly different or dramatically different? What does Stephen do? And, you know, everyone told me he passionately makes his case. He'll very vigorously disagree with anyone, including the president. But once the president has made a decision, he respects it and he doesn't question it and he acts on it. And when, you know, a directive comes from Stephen Miller, people respect that because they know it's coming from the president. Mm. But the flip side is that before the president has made a decision, Stephen Miller is very much in his ear, making a very forceful argument on why we should, you know, potentially use force to take Greenland. And so he does have a lot of influence over the president.
Yeah, he was integral in the capture of the Venezuelan president. I assume he has a pretty big role in negotiations behind closed doors on Iran at the moment too. I mean, he's in everything. His passion might be immigration, but he has his fingers all over the place.
Yeah. And one of the first times I sort of fully understood that was during Signalgate, where, as you may recall, my editor, the editor of The Atlantic, Jeffrey Goldberg, inadvertently got added to a confidential Signal chat with administration officials, with the vice president, the director of national intelligence, you know, the chief of staff, the defense secretary, debating a bombing campaign in Yemen. And so Jeff publishes this exchange and does a story on it. And what you see in the chats is that Stephen, in many ways, is the lowest in ranking among this group, right? He's not a cabinet secretary. He's not a Senate confirmed position. He's not a lawyer by training. And they're kind of going back and forth about, do we bomb Yemen? Do we not? And it's Stephen Miller. It's not the vice president. It's not the Pentagon chief. It's Stephen Miller who sort of ends the discussion and says, you know what the president wants. We're going to do this. And everyone's sort of like, okay. And then they go on and they bomb Yemen.
And we got a pretty telling insight, didn't we, into how Stephen Miller is thinking during a recent CNN interview where he talked about the US as a superpower.
Yeah, I mean, I'm paraphrasing here, but this interview got a lot of attention for good reason. He sort of basically said, like, we're a superpower and we damn well ought to act like a superpower, and the world responds to strength and force, and that's what we're going to use. And I think it was pretty jarring for a lot of people.
The United States is using its military to secure our interests unapologetically in our hemisphere. We're a superpower, and under President Trump, we are going to conduct ourselves as a superpower. The future of the free world depends on America being able to assert ourselves and our interests without apology.
So some people, including Senator Bernie Sanders, also on CNN, he argued that this is what imperialism is. This is the new world order, according to Donald Trump and Stephen Miller. It's what they want. It's what they're creating.
And all that that is throughout the history of the world. When powerful nations went into poor, undeveloped areas and just exploited their resources.
One thing that's interesting is Donald Trump in 2016 especially ran, you know, as someone who was opposed to the Iraq war, was opposed to these forever wars. But he's never been quite as isolationist as I think some of his allies believed or would like him to be. He is very much open to what I think of as the kind of one and done doctrine. He likes these sort of short kinetic bursts of force. So a very powerful one-time bombing of Iran, a very powerful military operation in Venezuela, in which we, as it turned out, captured the president and brought him back to the United States to stand trial. And that's very much in line with Stephen Miller's view of the military and power and force.
He seems to think that the president does have ultimate power. He used the term plenary authority during an interview on CNN, you know, that the president has absolute power. He can do whatever he wants. Do you think that's what he thinks?
Let's just go back a little bit. In Donald Trump's first term, when I covered him, I remember, and I say this sort of tongue in cheek, but not really. He won the presidency. It's the first political office he's ever run for, and won. And he got there and he was sort of frustrated that it wasn't a monarchy, right? That he could want to do something, but you might have to get Congress on board, or there might be a law that gets in your way, or a regulation, or an international treaty. And he found that incredibly frustrating. What he wanted was that absolute authority and absolute power to do and say whatever he pleased. And when he came back to power this time, and when Stephen came back to power with him, that's very much what you're seeing. You're seeing a president and a team around him, a senior team around him, who feels quite comfortable pushing through boundaries and shattering norms and moving the Overton window. And, you know, as he told the New York Times recently, the only constraint he sees for himself in the foreign policy realm is his own morality.
Do you see any checks on your power on the world stage? Is there anything that could stop you if you wanted to?
Yeah, there's one thing, my own morality, my own mind. That's the only thing that can stop.
And, not international law.
And that's
law.
Very good. I don't need international law.
As you say, he's always been very deeply conservative. He's only 40 years old. Now, he really unleashed, I think you could say, after the assassination of activist Charlie Kirk. At the memorial, he was saying things like, "Our enemies cannot comprehend our strength."
We are the storm, and our enemies cannot comprehend our strength, our determination, our resolve, our passion. They cannot imagine what they have awakened. They cannot conceive of the army that they have arisen in all of us.
Some of the things he says, it's quite extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. And it seems like from the outside and from reporting that he already had extreme far-right views, but that he became a bit darker and maybe even more radicalized after Charlie Kirk's assassination. And part of that has to do with the legitimate threats that he and his wife and their three children, and she's pregnant with a fourth, are facing. So we reported in The Atlantic they had to move into housing on a military base because they didn't feel safe in their house. He has a very robust Secret Service detail. At some point in his public rhetoric, you sort of see him merging what's happening to him personally, which I don't mean to downplay and I don't mean to minimize, with sort of the threats against the nation, and becoming very worried and very extreme on how those threats should be dealt with. And another example we mentioned in our piece, which is a little different, but his wife, Katie Miller, she's on Piers Morgan's YouTube show. She's on a panel and she's going back and forth arguing with a progressive guest. And this progressive guest is a naturalized citizen. And it's a disagreement of opinion. It's not a personal disagreement. He never mentions her family or her children. He never attacks her in that way. And then suddenly she sort of says, she makes an allusion to, "You better hope you have all of your papers in order with your, you know, naturalized citizenship."
So you better check your citizenship application and hope everything was legally and correct. We're disgusting. That doesn't mean that Israel,
which is an incredibly scary threat, if you are a naturalized citizen and the person threatening you is married to the immigration czar whose stated goal is to deport people left and right. And so you see this merging of the personal and the political kind of spilling out in public with the Miller family.
All right. Well, if the first weeks of 2026 are anything to go by, it's going to be a wild ride and potentially a pretty dangerous one by the sound of it. Now, Stephen Miller's wife, who you mentioned, Katie Miller, she recently posted a picture of an American flag over a map of Greenland on social media. What do you think? Is he going to go after that next? What's the chances? I guess that that's the next thing we just might see.
I mean, again, this is interesting in that, to me, one of the things is it just totally shows the difference between the first Trump term and the second Trump term. In the first Trump term, you know, it was reported that Trump maybe wanted to buy Greenland, which I think he legitimately did. And it was treated as kind of an outlandish idea, and it kind of just faded away. The first term chatter of Greenland felt like fan fiction whim, and second term talk of Greenland feels like a very real possibility of we can't predict what happens next.
Ashley Parker is a staff writer at The Atlantic and lead author of the article, The Wrath of Stephen Miller. This episode was produced by Sydney Peed, audio production by Sam Dunn. Our supervising producer is David Cody. I'm Sam Hawley. ABC News Daily. We'll be back again on Monday. Thanks for listening.